our myths say about us? And why do we choose to believe stories that have been disproven by science? In Myths of the Runestone, Viking Martyrs and the Birthplace of America, David Kruger takes an in-depth look at a legend that held tremendous power in one corner of Minnesota, helping to define a community's identity for decades. In 1898, a Swedish immigrant farmer claimed to have discovered a large rock with the writing carved into its surface in a field near Kensington, Minnesota. The writing was interpreted to tell a North American origin story predating Christopher Columbus's exploration, in which Viking missionaries reached what is now Minnesota in 1362, only to be massacred by Native Americans. The tale's credibility and the inscription's authenticity was quickly challenged and ultimately undermined by experts. But the myth took hold. Popular faith in the dubious artifact emerged as a local expression of American civil religion, which appealed to Scandinavian immigrants, Catholics, small-town boosters, and those looking to commemorate the white settlers who died in Dakota War of 1862. This book is a case study of how myths are created, propagated, and adapted over time, and reveals something unique about Americans' preoccupation with divine right and its troubled way of coming to terms with the history of the continent's first residents. In our conversation, we discussed myth, small-town life and Minnesota civic identity, martyrdom, secularization, the Cold War, Vikings, Marian devotion, Native Americans, Christian identity in Minnesota, American civil religion, and the multiple venues for using this book in the classroom. Thanks for listening to New Books in Religion. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson. And without further ado, here's my conversation with Dave Kruger about Myths of the Runestone, Viking Martyrs, and the Birthplace of America.
Hey, I'm great, Christian. Thanks a lot for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, now this is a great book and one that I think is useful to anyone in the study of religion because it brings in so many interesting examples and case studies and really kind of pushes the boundaries of kind of our theoretical model. So I really appreciate you writing it in such a clear way, and I'm looking forward to talking about it.
Right. Well, me too.
Before we get into the book, our tradition here at New Books in Religion is to find out a little bit about how you got to the study of religion. So can you tell us a little bit about your background, perhaps mentors or moments that were influential in steering you to the study of religion?
I think the category of religion and faith has always had a fairly strong pull on my life ever since when I was growing up in rural Minnesota. I grew up in a tradition called the Swedish Baptist tradition. It was a Pietist sect, kind of broke away from the Lutherans in Sweden in the 19th century and came to the U.S. And that was the kind of the ethnic religious, ethno-religious tradition that I grew up in. Went to an evangelical college in Minnesota. And even post-college, I always found that religion was kind of a motivating factor in my life. And I came to North Philadelphia and worked as a volunteer with young people in an at-risk neighborhood in North Philly. And I found that through that kind of like the religious impulse that pushed me to engage in a life of service, it also really challenged me to question the status quo. And working in an underprivileged neighborhood really helped to kind of sharpen my social criticism and my critique of the status quo. And I think that in many ways really shaped the way that I've approached my academic career as well. I always had this deep passion for learning and trying to dig deeper into understanding the framework of how things fit together, how society is structured, how it enacts its will on us, so to speak. And I tiptoed into the academic life through seminary and first pursued a Master's of Divinity course, which was just seemed like the obvious thing to do as a youth minister in the neighborhood. But once I got into seminary, I realized that I was really wanting to engage in a deeper level beyond just the practicalities of ministry, but I really wanted to think critically about society, how religious assumptions are framed and constructed. And I got two seminary degrees. My second seminary adventure was in Princeton in New Jersey. And I remember taking a class by a guy named Richard Fenn. He was a sociologist of religion up there, and he wrote a book called Return of the Primitive. And I remember reading that book, and it was a really tough book. But I felt so motivated to dig into it and to really understand what it was going for. And one of the themes that just stood out to me in that book was a sense of contemporary societies in so many ways are kind of possessed or captivated in by the past. In the sense of the certain aspects of the past that are unresolved, that haven't been come to terms with, find their way of probing into the present and influencing how we conduct our social lives today. And that past anxieties, if they're not resolved, continue to come back to haunt us. And Fenn's book just really opened my imagination to thinking about history, and to thinking about some of the things that I wanted to write about. So I continued further graduate studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. I applied to a number of seminaries just because I was kind of familiar with that type of worldview, this kind of Protestant and even a liberal Protestant worldview. But Temple really opened me to some very new, some really exciting possibilities. And studying along with Muslims and Jews and humanists and people from all these different traditions really opened my mind up to seeing religion in a much broader and richer way, far beyond this obsession with beliefs that was so much a part of my kind of Protestant habitus or way of seeing the world. A couple of essays and books that really impacted me. Robert Bella's essay on American civil religion was one that fascinated me. Being able to conceive of religion as something that exceeded beyond the bounds of traditional religion, but something that permeated American culture itself. And I thought that was just stimulated my imagination in some really interesting ways. And reading Pierre Bourdieu's notion of symbolic violence, that deeply resonated with me as well. This notion of how, asking the questions of how do the powerful make it appear as if their privilege and power is deserved or perhaps even ordained by God. So I'm so grateful to folks like Terry Ray and John Raines and John Paul and Rebecca Alpert and David Watt. They were all instrumental in really getting me more and more excited about my project, which we're talking about today.
That's great. And how did this project start? How did it emerge as a kind of a book-length object?
Well, I think there's a huge autobiographical piece to this work as well, because I write about the kind of the cultural civic religion of a small town, of a region of Minnesota. And that's where I grew up. I grew up on a farm not far from Alexandria. And I grew up in a community that was obsessed with its origins. They talked about the first settlers who came in 1858 and settled in the town, the white settlers that were there. But they also talked about a deeper history that went far before. And I never heard much about Native American history as a child growing up in school, but I did hear an awful lot about Viking history. There's a myth in my town that Vikings had visited the region in the year 1362, long before Columbus, of course. There was the belief that these Vikings had been there on a special mission. Now, by the time that I went to was growing up, this myth had been largely discredited, and there was this tall, 28-foot-tall Viking statue made out of fiberglass, which stands in the middle of the town. It's kind of a silly-looking statue. He's holding a spear and a shield, and on the shield are the words that are emblazoned, Alexandria, Minnesota, birthplace of America. This kind of audacious claim that this small town in Minnesota was the place where America, however we define that, began. So in many ways, I grew up with this kind of a kitschy iconography in the town, this kind of myth that had been discredited. I didn't think so deeply about it, but once I had gone to graduate school and began to think about the power of myth the power of symbols and how they define a community and how they embody the values, the hopes, the dreams of society. I just found that this story in my hometown was a rich, fertile field that required deeper analysis.
Now, this project, you did a lot of work on this during your graduate studies at Temple. Can you talk a little bit about perhaps things that you had to do in order to form it into the book? Going from the dissertation to the book, did you have to reform it or add things, take things away? How did that process work for you?
Well, if listeners are interested in reading the dissertation, it's actually called The Cult of the Kensington Runestone, Cultural Power and the Production of American Civil Religion. And you can get a copy of it on your search engines via ProQuest. So I completed the dissertation and defended, finished in 2011. And at that point, you know, I'd spent 3 years I spent basically because of my my wife's employment situation, we had actually relocated from Philadelphia to Minnesota, my home state. So I spent about 3 years studying for my comp exams and doing all the research. And I was pretty burned out because I was so immersed in this topic for that time period. So I let it rest for a few months. And then gradually I got into working on a proposal and started to rewrite a few of the first chapters. Now, the dissertation had about 330 pages worth of material, which, I mean, in my view, it was just too much as far as turning it into a book. So I had to do a lot of trimming. Really, from the very beginning, I wanted this book to be, you know, what publishers refer to as a crossover book, a book that would have, you know, academic chops, so to speak, but also a book that would have some popular appeal. I really wanted my research to be accessible to a fairly broad audience. To me, you know, writing for a very narrow academic field just hasn't felt very satisfying. I really wanted to somehow connect with the public because I felt like it was a really important topic to do so. So when I began really digging into it and reworking it, I found that I had to really reorganize reconceptualize how I organized the text. You know, the dissertation, the first chapter was all, you know, the introduction, the literature review, which is the staple of the dissertation, a lot of in-depth theoretical analysis and kind of like summary of theories. And basically, I just had to really kind of throw most of it out and just try to glean some of the main conceptual ideas and reintegrate that into the body of the work. Another chapter that I totally dismantled was my chapter which gave basically about a 60-year history of the scientific and pseudoscientific arguments of, is this Kensington Runestone artifact authentic or is it not? And I just kind of summarized all the arguments for and against. But when I began to think about it more, I began to realize that when people are making scientific arguments and scientific claims, they aren't just arguing from a purely rational perspective. Their arguments, all of these arguments about this controversial artifact are deeply rooted in cultural desires and certainly in political agendas. And it felt really important to me to integrate this story of the debate deep into the cultural fabric of all these communities that took an interest in this very fascinating artifact. So ended up with the University of Minnesota Press after I submitted it to a couple of other presses. And I feel really pleased with what the U of M Press did with the manuscript. I'm really grateful for their help and guidance along the way.
Yeah, it seems like a perfect fit, of course, too. So the book revolves around this artifact, we can maybe call it, the Kensington Runestone. Can you just, so we all start off on the same page, what is this, what does it say, and what is kind of the common narrative about its history?
The story of the Kensington Runestone begins in 1898. And as the story is typically told, there was a Swedish immigrant farmer by the name of Olof Oman who was out in his field in western Minnesota, Douglas County, near the village of Kensington, and he was clearing trees off of his land in order to expand his farm fields. And he was using this winch mechanism to pull an aspen tree, the roots out of the ground. And as the roots peeled back, as the story goes, his son Edward found this strange slab of stone with markings carved into the surface. And within days, supposedly he had shared this with his other neighbors, and the common narrative is that they didn't know what it was, so they sent it off to the University of Minnesota and eventually the University of Chicago to analyze what this inscription was. So that's kind of like the traditional story, the way that it's been told. Now, the inscription on the stone is important to get a sense of what the words actually say. Fairly quickly, the message was translated into English. The script carved into the stone was actually fairly quickly recognized by the largely Swedish and Norwegian immigrant population in the region. They recognized these letters to be runes. Part of the runic alphabet. Essentially, that is the runic runes are the script that was used by Scandinavian people before the Latinized alphabet was introduced to Scandinavia. So the inscription was translated, the face of the inscription was translated as follows. 8 Swedes and 22 Norwegians on an exploration journey from Vinland westward. We had our camp by 2 rocky islets, 1 day's journey north of the stone. We were out fishing one day. When we came home, we found 10 men red with blood and dead. AVM, save us from evil. The year, 1362. So this inscription fascinated the local community, especially the date of 1362. This was 140 years before Christopher Columbus had sailed into the Bahamas in the Western Hemisphere. So if this artifact could be proven to be true, it would show that European America began in the heart of the continent long before Christopher Columbus. And this would cause the history books to be rewritten. So the local community pinned their hopes on this artifact. Now, over time, and we can talk about this more in details later, but just to give you the overview, the locals, with the help of several interpreters, which I'll mention later, Hjalmar Holland in particular, they began to kind of embellish this narrative. And over time, it became kind of a North American origin story, which described these Scandinavian explorers as Viking missionaries that reached the area on a mission to save the Christian faith. And half of the group did not survive because they were massacred by the local native population. Now, this artifact was fairly quickly determined to be the product of a hoax. Most scholars at the University of Chicago and University of Minnesota said that, you know, very likely it was Olaf Oman and some of his neighbors that must have carved the inscription on the slab of stone as a practical joke to prove that their ethnic group was great, and it was simply just a joke that had gotten out of hand. And I can talk more later about the reasons for, well, I'll mention it now. Over time in the past, you know, decades and even early on, they recognized that the language used in the inscription did not properly resemble the language used in the 14th century. And even recently, there's a scholar named Henrik Williams from Uppsala University in Sweden. And he's done some research and found out that there are particular word usages in this inscription that were actually quite commonly used in parts of Sweden in the 1880s. So therefore, the local population of the immigrants that came to Minnesota could have had access to the type of language used in the inscription. There's also the geological evidence is pretty ambiguous about this runestone as well, because if I didn't know much about stone inscriptions before researching this project, but I've learned now that it's nearly impossible to date with any accuracy the age of a stone inscription. And then, of course, there's also the circumstances of now we have no other corroborating proof that Vikings traveled any further westward than Newfoundland. We do know that as of the 1960s, we do know that Vikings did indeed travel to North America. There is a settlement on the northeastern tip of Newfoundland called Lonza Meadows. And even just a few, several months ago, there was a Discovery Channel show that was looking into the possibility of Vikings mining bog ore and had possibly even settled or spent some time in the southeastern tip of Newfoundland, getting them a little bit closer towards the mainland of North America. But most scholars have pretty roundly said that this artifact is not legitimate. It was probably created in the 19th century by Oman or his neighbors, but yet people were enchanted by the story that it inspired, and they refused to let this belief go.
And this is really what makes this book of yours really, really fascinating. And to think through the importance of the stone and how it was utilized, and remember, you frame it in this kind of narrative of civil religion, and especially this idea of myth. So could you talk a little bit about the concept of civil religion and how you employ it, and what does using this framework, how does it aid you in your analysis?
Well, I think this book really poses some questions that I think are really fundamental to the study of religion, the study of history, and the study of group identity. For me, I think what the important question is, you know, is not whether or not the artifact is scientifically valid. Is it what it claims to be historically? I think the fascinating thing is what this stone has meant as a kind of a civic totem, as a civic symbol for people in Minnesota. I think the important question is, you know, what do our myths say about who we are? What can we learn about ourselves by the stories that we find ourselves telling? And as far as like a question of, you know, this debates between religion and science and how they relate with one another, one of the driving questions that I think drives this book is this notion of why do we persist in believing stories that have been disproven by science, by scientific and historical analysis. So it really is a book that I think that takes a really deep look at how this story became so deeply popular and so ingrained in the local identity, even when the scientific evidence was flimsy at best throughout. Perhaps I could just talk a little bit about American civil religion for your audience who may not be as familiar with that term. The term was coined in 1967 by a sociologist named Robert Bella. And he argued that he thought of religion in terms of, you know, something that went beyond simply institutional religion, the Catholic Church, the Lutheran Church, or Islam or something like that. You know, Bella interpreted the ways that Americans viewed history in meaningful ways as a form of civil religion. So he saw that, he recognized that, interpreting American history in terms of ultimate values and ultimate authority is a way of conceiving of American patriotism or national identity in kind of a quasi-religious type of a form. And I think Bella has often been criticized, and by the time that I even read Bella in, you know, the mid to late 2000s, Bella was kind of had become out of fashion. This concept of civil religion had become out of fashion simply for justifiable reasons, because I think it led to this impression that that there's supposed to be this national shared consensus that we all hold certain values and beliefs in common as Americans. But some of the more recent and innovative treatments of civil religion have begun to think of it in terms of what Art Remillard would refer to as civil religions rather than civil religion. So I see the story of the Kensington Runestone and the popular fascination, this popular movement that rose up around this myth as a form of a localized civil religion. It's how a local community appropriated, some of the narratives and themes of, American manifest destiny and God's chosenness for the nation, and somehow appropriated them into the local setting. For example, I think in American religious history, a lot of the way that history is told oftentimes is this notion that, American history, the United States began with these Protestants, these pilgrims, these Puritans in the Northeast, or maybe the Anglicans in Virginia or something like that. History for too long, in many ways has been told with that kind of a Protestant East Coast bias to it. But in a way, this story of the Kensington Runestone really problematizes this kind of dominant American civil religious story by saying that no, the United States or America, as they describe it, began in the Midwest by Vikings, by Northern Europeans, and who just happened to be Catholic. And we'll talk about the Catholic piece a little bit later. So in many ways, this American civil religion is constructed by these Western Minnesotans. It appropriates large American themes, but it localizes it and makes the story to serve local purposes and local concerns. So I think in that way, Myths of the Runestone offers another example of how there are a diversity of civil religious expressions in the U.S. today.
Now, much of the popularity of the stone is due to one man, Hjalmar Holland. Can you tell us who he was and why is he so important to this narrative of the Runestone?
Hjalmar Holland is an utterly fascinating figure. As I researched into the archives, one thing that I really wish I could have found would be some video of him speaking or an audio recording or something like that. He really was a really fascinating figure. He was born in Norway. He immigrated to Wisconsin as a pretty young man, and his first job was to be a traveling book salesman. So he would travel all through the rural area selling books to people. So he kind of had this salesman type of mentality. Now, Hjalmar Holland is almost wholly responsible for the popularity of the Kensington Runestone in the 20th century. Not about, a couple of years after Oman discovered the stone, university experts declared it to be a hoax. As the story goes, Oman returned it to his farm and essentially stored it in his granary for several years. But in 1907, Hjalmar Holland was traveling across Minnesota, and he was on a project to gather pioneer stories of Norwegian immigrants in the upper Midwest. And as Holland tells the story, he just happened to stumble upon Oman's farm and found this interesting artifact. And told Oman, gee, this is really a fascinating piece of work you have here. This could prove that our ancestors, our Swedish-Norwegian ancestors, were the first white people to come to this area. I'd like to take the stone. I'd like to buy the stone from you or take it from you and do some more research on it. And Oman at that time released ownership of the stone to Holland, who took it for research. And at that point in 1907, he began a decades-long crusade to prove this stone to be true. He wrote several books. He wrote dozens of articles. He traveled to Europe, to France, to Sweden, to Norway, all over the United States, touting this runestone as an authentic artifact. So we have to ask the question of what was his motivating factor? What was he trying? Did he have invested in this stone? We know from other evidence that Holand had actually been attempting to track down this stone for a number of years. So he was a bit dishonest in his narratives about how he came across it. We know that Holand used the story of the runestone as a prologue for his Norwegian immigrant history. So in his very opening of the book, he discusses how the Vikings kind of paved the way for his Norwegian immigrant forebears in the 19th century. So clearly he had an agenda to do that. And Holand had some very interesting strategies. Perhaps we can talk a little bit about how he was able to convince so many people that this runestone was authentic. You know, he spent decades proving this thing to be the real deal. And he was so effective that by the 1960s, a Minneapolis newspaper recorded that 60% of Americans believed that Vikings had visited Minnesota prior to Columbus. So he was able to powerfully influence the public. And he did so using some pretty flimsy pieces of scientific evidence. I'll share with you a couple of them. He had a theory that he had found throughout the Minnesota countryside a number of boulders that had holes chiseled into them. He claimed that these so-called holy boulders, as I like to call them, were used to anchor Viking ships as they traveled across the Minnesota landscape. He also found farmers would bring him supposed Viking swords and battle axes that they had dug up in their farm fields across the landscape. And also he had a theory that there were a number of ethnographic accounts of Mandan Indians having blonde hair and blue-eyed characteristics in the Dakota Territory. So this all proved to Holand that the Vikings had been everywhere in Minnesota. They'd carved these boulders, left their weapons, and intermarried with the local native people. But over time, researchers discovered that these boulders had actually been chiseled out to hold dynamite because farmers would blast boulders for foundation rock for their buildings. The Viking battle axes that they had found were actually well-known tobacco cutters that were put out by a battle axe tobacco company. These blonde, blue-eyed Indians that they had Holland had talked about had actually intermarried with Spanish and French explorers. But to the public, they didn't care about the evidence. They found his narrative so compelling that they were able to look beyond any of the holes in his evidence and were able to follow his story. Holland had a tremendously charismatic personality, and he was a very seductive writer. One of the documents that helped him tell this story was an obscure letter that he found in the Danish archives. And this letter was written by Sweden's King Magnus in the 14th century. And this letter called for an expedition to Greenland to find colonists who were feared to have abandoned the Christian faith or gone native, so to speak. There's no proof. There is an actual letter in the Danish archives, but there's no proof that King Magnus ever carried out this expedition, no proof that it ever came to fruition. But yet, that story was critical. The more criticism that Holland faced for his evidence, he kept embellishing the story by adding this notion of these were Viking Christians, these were missionaries, saving the faith, and they had sacrificed their lives to save the faith. And little by little, he was able to generate popular support because so many different groups found a way to invest themselves in the importance of the story that he was telling.
Yeah, and one of the main concerns at the turn of the 20th century here was Rethinking the Dakota War of 1862, and how white Americans, their relationships with Native Americans, and how they made sense of, I guess, conquest and expansion into the American West. Can you talk a little bit about how the stone figures into this context?
There's something very interesting in the inscription of the stone. I think you'll remember that I mentioned that the date on the inscription is 1362. Now, in Minnesota history, perhaps the most traumatic event, significant event in Minnesota history, is the Dakota War of 1862. I think there's an interesting parallel between those two numbers. There's a very neat 500-year discrepancy between those two dates, and I think that they are somehow related in the mind of the person who created this inscription. So let me explain a little bit of more background. The Dakota War of 1862 came about after Minnesota statehood. It became a state in 1858. Prior to that, there had been a great deal of negotiation between the local Dakota tribes living in southern Minnesota and the new white settlers who were moving into the region. And the Dakota people had essentially given up vast segments of land in very fraudulently put together treaties, given a very minimal amount of money. But essentially, the tribes were strong-armed into this to the negotiating table. So by 1862, the local Dakota had relinquished another segment of land along the Minnesota. So by this point, they were living along a very narrow strip of land along the Minnesota River. And by 1862, this was the heart of the American Civil War. And the annuities that were promised to the Dakota bands that lived along this river were not coming through because the federal government was occupied by the American Civil War. So when the annuities were delayed, the local Dakota people were facing starvation because they weren't able to get the food they needed to survive, the food that was promised to them. So during the summer of 1862, Dakota warriors raided a government warehouse, took their food back, took their annuities back from forcibly. And some Dakota warriors actually went out to the countryside and killed white settlers. And the whole thing blew up into a violent conflict where perhaps a few hundred white settlers were killed over a matter of just a few weeks' time. Now, within a couple of weeks, Fort Snelling near Minneapolis dispatched troops. They brutally crushed the Dakota people's uprising, and they sentenced over 400 Dakota men to death in a hastily thrown together military tribunal. There was an intervention by President Lincoln, and only 38 were executed. But in the months after that execution, which took place in Mankato, Minnesota, in December 26, 1862, this was actually the largest mass execution in U.S. history, even to today. It happened in Minnesota. Within months after that execution, nearly all of the Dakota people were forcibly exiled from the state of Minnesota, dropping from a population of 6,000 to less than 100 or so within a year. So it was a violent removal from the landscape. And I think that for many, clearly for decades after this Dakota War, many white people were traumatized, understandably, by this event. And they were fascinated by commemorating this event in very interesting ways. They had these tableaus that would travel around the countryside, and people would view paintings of these violent massacre settings of white people, of course, making white people to be purely innocent, and the native people being purely pure evil. And my argument is that whoever created this Kensington runestone very likely had the Dakota War in mind in some way. And certainly by the time the stone was discovered, people interpreted the dead Vikings. Now remember, the inscription says nothing about native people. It simply says these Norsemen were found dead and red with blood. But for 20th century Minnesotans, it was obvious to them that it could only be Native people who perpetrated this crime. And I think as I've read the archival materials and the books, I'll find repeated references to there's one writer in particular, Constant Larson, who described he included the story of the Kensington Runestone as a parallel story to the Dakota War, what he called the Sioux outbreak of 1862. And in both chapters, he describes the Indians who killed the Vikings as savages. He describes the Indians who killed the Norwegians and the Germans and the Swedes in the 19th century as savages. So throughout the language of those who have defended the Runestone over the years, they have made a clear and distinct link between the Indians of the past and the Indians of the 19th century. So in my mind, the Kensington Runestone story functions as what René Girard might refer to as a scapegoat ritual, where by the retelling of this history narrative, they were able to demonstrate that the Indians of the distant past were just as violent as the Native people from the recent past, and therefore their removal from the landscape was justified and required because they were essentially savage and incapable of living in a white community. So I can see in many ways that this Runestone provided, or at least kind of expresses, I think, the attitudes that white Minnesotans had towards Native people, even in the early 20th century.
And as we get into the 20th century, the stone takes on kind of a new symbolic meaning, almost representative of small town life, Midwestern American ideals. How was this identity constructed? What did it look like? And how was it basically socialized into Minnesota culture?
In 1920, Sinclair Lewis published a novel called Main Street. And in this novel, it was a depiction of a western Minnesota town not far from Alexandria and Kensington. And this depiction by Sinclair Lewis portrayed the town as kind of parochial, backward, simple, uneducated. And many of the local folks felt attacked. Like their identity, their self-esteem was attacked. This was a time period when small town life was lauded as the ideal. Main Street was supposed to be the ideal of what America ought to be. But this novel, written by a young man, Sinclair Lewis, from this part of Minnesota, not far from where I grew up, he was viewed as attacking the region. So I argue that the Kensington Runestone played a helpful role in bolstering the self-esteem of this region, because this artifact could prove that small town Minnesota was significant in the American story. And as I read many of the boosters of the Runestone in the 1920s, they would compare this small town in Minnesota to Boston and Philadelphia. And they would say, like, you know, why do these tourists, they go to Philadelphia and Boston, but they really ought to come to Western Minnesota because that's where the real history is out here. So it boosted the self-esteem in so many very interesting ways. And the artifact itself emerged as kind of a totem, a representative of the region. And I trace the kind of the apotheosis of this artifact. And Holland and others performed civic rituals such as this one fundraising rally where they stationed two National Guardsmen next to the stone and kind of gave it this aura of a sacred, important artifact. And by treating the artifact in this way, it began to kind of raise the prestige, this kind of cultural capital of this artifact in the eyes of the public. And by the 1950s or 1940s, actually, the Runestone had gained so much local popularity, and Holland had created such a kind of public spectacle of this Runestone that he managed to convince the Smithsonian Institution in D.C. to host the artifact for a year. And reading the newspaper articles from the Minneapolis newspapers, the big city newspapers, and the small town newspapers. It's really quite fascinating because you get a sense of how much the local folks in Alexandria invested in this artifact as a representative of their community. Especially even as when the runestone went to the World's Fair in 1965, the New York World's Fair held in Queens. And the runestone stood as an emblem of Minnesota at the Minnesota exhibit at the World's Fair. And locals at one point expressed concern that their artifact would become desecrated at this fair, that people would be making fun of it at some point. And when there was some internal issues with the exposition and they ran out of money and they had to close it down, they immediately dispatched Harvey Hammergren, the local civic leader of the community, and he drove all the way out to New York from Minnesota, picked up the runestone, wrapped it in a blanket, and put it in the back of his 1965 Buick and drove it all the way back to Minnesota where it could be safe. So you can see a sense of this artifact stood as a representative of the identity of the significance of small town America, and these civic events where the runestone got national attention, these were opportunities for small town America to hold up their values and their beliefs before a national audience. And it was an opportunity for them to boost their self-esteem as a local community.
Now, anyone that knows anything about Minnesota knows that it is expressively Lutheran in character. Catholics in the region were not left out in this narrative. So could you talk a little bit about how Catholics used the runestone in their own construction of Christian identity and how they deployed it in specific contexts?
Just a couple of years after Hjalmar Holland began his public crusade to prove the runestone true, he found some allies among local Catholic leaders in Minnesota, and the most famous of which is Archbishop John Ireland. He's one of America's most famous Catholics of the early 20th century, certainly Minnesota's most famous Catholic. And the Archbishop was somehow convinced to show up to one of Hjalmar Holland's promotional meetings held at the Minnesota Historical Society in 1909. And I was pondering this question of, like, why would the Archbishop, you know, an incredibly busy leader, why would he come out to hear a presentation about this obscure Scandinavian artifact found in a very Protestant part of Minnesota? And as I began to dig deeper into the story, I realized that there were some very good reasons for him to do so. One of which was that Archbishop Ireland was working hard to convert Lutheran Scandinavians. Scandinavians in Minnesota were, of course, as you mentioned, were primarily Lutheran. I think it's very credible that Ireland was trying to find a way of endorsing the runestone as a means of reaching this Protestant community by reminding them that Scandinavia, before the Protestant Reformation, was indeed a Catholic place. Now, the date on this runestone inscription is 1362. That was before the Protestant Reformation. So these Vikings, as I mentioned before, were actually Catholic Vikings in the eyes of Archbishop Ireland, especially those letters in the inscription that I mentioned, AVM. Ireland interpreted those letters to stand for Ave Virgo Maria. So for Ireland, he interpreted the Ave AVM, Save Us From Evil, as the first Catholic prayer ever uttered in North America. So in a sense, he was able to use this as kind of a symbolic tool to persuade, to invite these Scandinavians back to their original faith of Scandinavia. And on a second level, we have to remember, if you know anything about Catholic history in America, Catholics were frequently the targets of suspicion, frequently marginalized in social life, often sometimes the targets of violence. In Minnesota, it was a region where Catholics did have some level of prominence. There were Irish Catholics, and there was a strong German Catholic presence in the region. But still, in the early 20th century, Catholics had not reached the pinnacle of of local political power. In fact, it wasn't even until the 1980s that Minnesota had a Catholic governor. So I think Ireland saw this as a way, this runestone, as a way of bolstering Catholic social capital in the state, because he could prove that the earliest white people, the earliest Europeans in Minnesota, were actually Catholics and not these Lutherans who had such, you know, social power in this at the state at the time. And the story just grew throughout the 20th century. We saw other archbishops, a bishop of Minnesota, our bishop of central Minnesota, who took on the runestone and during the 1950s was advocating a devotion to what he called Our Lady of the Runestone. And I visited a local Catholic church nearby Alexandria. It's actually in the village of Kensington. And there's actually a parish called Our Lady of the Runestone. And it was named for the Kensington Runestone. And there's a just an incredible portrait. I have it in one of the pages, one of the photos in my book, of the Virgin Mary standing in the North American landscape with her hands lifted to the sky. There's a Viking ship in the background. There's the North Star behind her. And there's the runestone that is sticking out of the ground, and she is offering a prayer in the landscape. And if you look closely at that image as well, you'll also see a small star in Mexico, which represents the appearance of the Virgin of Guadalupe. And I think that's an interesting juxtaposition, that this is kind of perhaps a Nordic version, or a Northern European, a white version of the Virgin Mary, not necessarily appearing in the landscape, but yet in this portrait blessing the presence of white Catholics in North America.
Now, in the mid-20th century, we have changing social context. We have the Cold War. We have attitudes towards religion changing a little bit, or at least fears of decline in religion. What was going on during this time, and how was the stone redeployed or rearticulated in this kind of changing environment of the 1950s and 60s?
The 1960s and 50s and even into the early 70s, it was a particularly rich, culturally rich time for the Kensington Runestone enthusiasm. And one of the most fascinating documents that I found in the archives was a comic book called Mystery of the Runestone. And in this comic book is a narrative telling and a pictorial telling of the imagined journey of the Vikings, the Norsemen, to North America. And one of the, as I read this, this is a comic book. It's obviously it's written for a youth audience. It's written for young people in a very accessible way. This comic book was one of the main pieces of literature that accompanied the Minnesota exhibit at the World's Fair in 1965. And in this comic book, it is riddled with language of anxiety and fear about the Christian faith ever being at risk. So in each of the frames is this kind of unfolding narrative of King Magnus, this Christian, a benevolent king in Sweden, dispatches this Christian leader named Sir Paul Knutsen to lead this expedition to find colonists who had disappeared from Greenland, feared to have given up the Christian faith, searched all over North America. And all throughout this journey, we see kind of like images and references to Sir Paul Knutsen and the priest that was along with the group, reminding the other Vikings in the traveling party to stay faithful to God, to stay with the Christian faith. Don't turn to the pagan ways, the ancient Norse religion. Don't turn to the religion of the native people. And it's a very interesting as it unfolds as well. There's the kind of the centerpiece of this comic book is a kind of a bifold thing that you open up, and it's a vivid picture of what is called the Viking massacre site. So on this picture, you can see a landscape of Vikings sprawled all over the land next to this lakeside camp. They're covered in blood. Their weapons are laid out before them on the ground. You see priests walking around, weeping and praying and saying prayers to Ave Maria for the violent act that had taken place at this. So we get the sense that like there was a notion of a Christian. This was an incident of Christian martyrdom, that Christian heroic white missionaries had sacrificed their lives traveling through this savage and native landscape. And I think that this anxiety needs to be seen, the anxiety in this comic book needs to be seen in the larger anxieties going on during that time. I think it was 1962 where you had the Supreme Court case, which prevented teachers from saying prayers in public schools, the Bible reading in public schools. So there was a widespread example, a widespread anxiety about Christianity being disestablished or being its presence being threatened in public. So I think that there's and there's also like the Elmer. There was an Elmer a film called Elmer Gantry, another Sinclair Lewis novel that was turned into a film. And that film portrayed rural religious people as kind of like very backward, and they portrayed religious preachers as hucksters and manipulators and that kind of thing. So again, there's this kind of growing anxiety about the status quo or the cultural cachet of Christianity during that time. And I think this runestone narrative, the story of Viking sacrifice, dead Christian Vikings, helped to assuage some anxieties that were going on at the time. And in many of the writings, we see a direct parallel between a defense of the Kensington runestone was equated with a defense of the Christian faith itself. And there was a novel that was written called Immortal Rock, which really plays out this theme that defending the runestone meant defending the Christian faith. They were inextricably linked together.
Well, Dave, there's tons in this book that I love, lots of little examples like these that you go through, and of course we don't have time, but perhaps you could help listeners and hopefully future readers. It seems like a lot of these would work really well in the classroom. So do you have ideas about how you might use sections of the book or the whole book itself in the classroom?
I think it's pretty adaptable to a variety of college, university, seminary settings, study groups, book clubs. Like I said, I wrote it in a way that I think appeals to a lay audience and to an academic audience. It's a slim read. It's about 159 pages. It's got 34 pages of notes if you want to dig in deeper. And I think it can fit into a wide variety of classes. I mean, if you have a class dealing with myths, how they're created, how they're constructed, propagated, you know, if you have an American studies class, there are many themes that fit with this book. In a history class, it's a great project looking at collective memory, popular in how popular challenges have arisen to dominant history writing. This question of the ongoing quest for finding evidence of Europeans in pre-Columbian America. Religion, American civil religion, sacred spaces, sacred landscapes, Catholic American identity. Native Americans and race, how white people have appropriated and imagined Native people, how whiteness was constructed using Native people as a contrast, ethnicity, Scandinavian identity, immigrant religion, regional identity. And of course, I think what might be really fascinating is this notion of why there is such a widespread distrust for the scientific academic community. This strain of anti-intellectualism, which is not just going on today, but has deep roots in American history. Why is it that beliefs persist even when science contradicts? And lastly, I think it could be useful in a kind of a multidisciplinary humanities course, because it does touch on a lot of different traditions. So I'm available via Skype to speak to your class. I can offer other resources as well. And if you visit my book website at mythsoftherunestone.com, I have some helpful other ideas for how to use the book.
And I think just the range of topics that the book could be used for that you've laid out for us here makes me wonder what you're working on now, right? If you're dipping into so many different areas of study, you really could be going anywhere. So could you tell us a little bit about the types of things you are up to in your research now?
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, because I do feel like there are so many of these threads. Like, I could take just one chapter itself and just kind of like dig deeper and just go a million different directions. One thing that might be interesting to me, I've done some initial research on moving towards a kind of a book-length treatment of American myths in general, or maybe focusing specifically on other American discovery myths. The notion of St. Brennan the Irish Catholic coming to North America prior to Columbus, other myths of other groups coming to North America. It could be, you know, maybe a little bit broader to talk about the Christian nation myth more broadly, the myths of manifest destiny. There could be a number of ways to go. One of the challenges I face as an independent scholar, I'm not tied to a university, I'm not on the tenure track. I am working as a professional to kind of raise my own money to become a scholar, kind of a scholar entrepreneur. So I've been working as a public pedagogy consultant for a group called the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program, providing, educating the public about prison issues through them. So I'm able to make income through that, and also income through my work as a public historian. I've done a lot of work as a history tour guide in Philadelphia. So I give tours of religious and historic sites in Philadelphia. This is the town founded as a holy experiment by William Penn, a town where religious diversity was embraced, whereas other colonies, religious diversity was squelched. So there's lots of opportunity to research and to teach the public here. I've also done some work as a contributor for some TV networks, and those will be broadcast in January. I'm not able to say which networks they are at this point, but believe me, I will tell you all about it once it does go public. So I think as far as my scholarly research, I'm also trying to build on this Religion in Philadelphia project a little bit more deeply. I've done some writing about the new Mormon temple that was just built in Philadelphia. I wrote for Religion Dispatches recently. And I also have a project looking at Islamic men's clothing in Philadelphia, and I'll be doing a presentation on that for the American Academy of Religion this fall with a group looking at that. But some fun projects to look forward to if I can carve out the time and make the finances
busy
finances work, and raising a family, two young boys as well. It's a challenge.
Well, we wish you the best of luck, Dave, and thank you for cutting out some time to talk about your book.
My pleasure, Christian. I really enjoyed it.
That was my conversation with Dave Kruger about Myths of the Runestone, Viking Martyrs and the Birthplace of America, published by University of Minnesota Press in 2015. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion.